Hello, and thanks for tuning in to the 10th and Broad Church of Christ podcast. Today's episode is presented by Shane Kennedy, a youth minister at the 10th and Broad Church of Christ. Let's tune in now for Shane's message.
Well, Jeremy and I are starting a new series for the month of September, maybe our last series for a while as we get ready to welcome our new preacher in. But we entitled this series, When God's People Pray. And as we were planning and thinking about what we were going to talk about this month and for this series, it became clear to us that we needed to focus on prayer. We actually had, there was a couple people from the congregation that even recommended that we spend some time focusing on prayer. And is this not a good time as a church family for us to spend some time praying? So we thought that was an appropriate thing to do for now. But as we go through this time of transition, we get ready to welcome in a new preaching minister. I think this is a great time for us to just seek God's will as a church and to just let him direct our future and to kind of lay our church at God's feet. So we are going to intentionally and purposefully pray for the whole month of September for our church family. So we invite you to pray with us. And we're going to give you some specific ways that you can pray throughout the month. And then at the end of the month, we hope to end it with a 24-hour period of prayer that we're going to do as a church family. And we're also doing some planning and figuring it out, but we also hope to have maybe a special fasting and praying time for those who can participate as a church family as well. Well, it seems that it is often whenever we face moments of uncertainty or anxiousness, or maybe even desperation, that we feel the greatest need to pray. I think some of us have maybe felt that as we've gone through this transition, that as we've gone through maybe a little bit of period of uncertainty, that it's caused us to think that we need to pray a little more, that we need to lean on God a little more. And I think that's a good thing. So we feel a greater desire to really pray and to lean on God. And isn't that true about life, that it's often whenever we face our lowest moments in life or when we face moments of desperation that we call out to God and that we draw near to him in prayer? You know those moments that I'm talking about. I know I can look at specific times in my life that I desperately prayed to God or called out to him when I realized just how much I absolutely needed him. I think about times back in college, maybe right as I'm getting close to finals week, and I have some papers that I should have been working on all along, but I'd procrastinated, and I was like, oh man, am I going to get these done? And I'm calculating my grade to figure out what I got to make on the finals to see if I can pass, and I'm just praying that I can survive and that I can pass my classes. Or I think about whenever I first started in youth ministry at the church in Vernon, and I remember feeling, as I started out in ministry, just this huge weight that I had a responsibility of getting to help shape the spiritual lives of students. And I felt very inadequate as I started. I remember desperately praying to God for help and that he equipped me for the task. Or many of you know just how inadequate and terrified you feel whenever you first become a parent. Children have a way of humbling you and bringing you to your knees. So I remember praying quite a bit whenever I first became a dad. So what have been those desperate times for you in your life when you were brought to your knees because you realized just how much that you needed God's help? Was it times that you felt inadequate or that you just weren't enough? Was it times when life just hadn't worked out the way that you had hoped? Or maybe it's times when you had experienced hurt or loss that left you feeling lost and broken. And none of us really want to experience those moments in life. We'd rather avoid them. But it's often in those desperate moments that we draw near to God. So in a way, desperation can be a gift when it causes us to depend more on the Father. I think we saw that in the last series that we went through. We saw people whose desperation caused them to climb up trees and to push through crowds and even dig through roofs just so they could be near to Jesus. So maybe we need to be a little more desperate more often. The truth is, whether we're in good life circumstances or bad, we are always desperate for Jesus, whether we recognize it or not. Maybe we need to recognize our desperation a little more frequently. Well, as we go through this series, we're going to look at different examples of when God's people prayed. And this morning, we're going to look at a story of a woman who prayed out of desperation, and we're going to see how God responded to her prayer. So we're going to look at the story of Hannah found in 1 Samuel 1. Hannah's story took place during the time of the judges, and that was a difficult time for Israel where they really struggled to remain faithful to God. They kind of went through this continual cycle of turning away from him and living like the rest of the nations around them. And it wasn't until they faced oppression from some of their enemies that they would finally turn back to God and cry out to him. And at that point, God would raise up a hero or a judge to come and save his people. And so at the beginning of 1 Samuel, God has plans to raise up a new leader for Israel. And the story all begins with Hannah. So let's begin reading in 1 Samuel 1, verse 1 and 2. There's some names that are a mouthful. I don't know if I'm going to pronounce them right here, but let's not get too bogged down in the names. There was a certain man from Ramathaim, a Zophite from the hill country of Ephraim, whose name was Elkanah, son of Jehoram, the son of Elihu, the son of Tohu, the son of Zoph, an Ephraimite. He had two wives. One was called Hannah, and the other Peninnah. Peninnah had children, but Hannah had none. So we're introduced to a man named Elkanah, and he has two wives, Hannah and Peninnah. And already in just the first couple lines of the story, we see some of the hurt that's going to be a part of Hannah's story. Because she is not able to have children. She struggles with infertility. She longs to be a mother and to have a child, but she is not able to. And on top of not being able to have a child, her husband has another wife who is able to have children. So a good possibility of what may have happened is Elkanah may have married Hannah first, and whenever she was not able to bear him children, he took on a second wife, Peninnah, so that she could bear him children. And this is one of the many examples in the Bible, especially in the Old Testament, of polygamy, of a man taking more than one wife. And I think we need to be careful not to mistake these examples of polygamy as an endorsement by God, that God does not endorse this as his design for the family. In fact, if you look at many of these stories, pretty much every one of them, you see that polygamy, that taking on multiple wives, causes problems and hurts and just wreaks havoc for each one of those families. So that's not part of God's plan for marriage or for the family. And we'll see the hurt in this story that it causes. So Hannah struggles with infertility. And probably several in this room know all too well the pain and the hurt that comes from struggling with infertility. Statistically, about 1 in 6 couples struggle with infertility. It jumps to about 1 in 4 whenever it's over the age of 35. And one study shows that women struggling with infertility experience equivalent levels of emotional pain as women who experience a terminal or chronic disease or illness. But one difference is where someone dealing with a chronic illness or disease, they may receive comfort and support from people around them. Many times those who struggle with infertility do so alone, that many may not know about it, or the ones who do know may underestimate the pain that the person is experiencing. So experiencing infertility is painful in our context, but it was especially painful in Hannah's context. In that culture, childbearing was seen as the main purpose for a woman, that your value or your worth was wrapped up in whether or not you were able to bear children for your husband. In a largely agrarian society, children were also economically important as they helped provide workers for the fields. Also, it was very important to have sons, as later on they would help provide defense and protection in a time when their lands and their homes were often raided by their enemies. So if you were not able to bear children as a wife, you faced social embarrassment and shame. That often people saw barren women in that time as someone who was cursed by God, that maybe they had done something wrong that God was punishing them for. But it's interesting, if you look through the Bible, you see many examples of barren women. And if you went through and just made a list of all of them and looked at their stories, you would see that it's mainly made up of a list of righteous women. That you have people like Sarah, the wife of Abraham, or you have Rebecca, the wife of Isaac, or Rachel, Jacob's wife, or you have Elizabeth, the mother of John the Baptist. That many of these women are godly women who play a very important role in God's story. So if Hannah faces a difficult situation that she's not able to have children, but on top of that, it seems like many of the people in her life are not very helpful to the situation. So let's look at 1 Samuel chapter 1, starting in verse 3. Year after year, this man went up from his town to worship and sacrifice to the Lord Almighty at Shiloh, for Hophni and Phinehas, the two sons of Eli, were priests of the Lord. Whenever the day came for Elkanah to sacrifice, he would give portions of the meat to his wife Peninnah and to all her sons and daughters. But to Hannah he gave a double portion because he loved her and the Lord had closed her womb. Because the Lord had closed Hannah's womb, her rival kept provoking her in order to irritate her. This went on year after year. Whenever Hannah went up to the house of the Lord, her rival provoked her till she wept and would not eat. So Peninnah does not have any sympathy for Hannah in this moment, but rather it says that she provokes her because of her barrenness. And so every year it talks about when they would go up to the tabernacle at Shiloh to offer sacrifices to God, that Elkanah would give a portion of the meat to Peninnah and her children, but he would give a double portion to Hannah because he loved her. And perhaps it was out of jealousy that Peninnah decides to irritate and provoke Hannah and rub it in that she is not able to have children. And it said it would drive Hannah to the point of weeping into where she wouldn't even want to eat, that she would lose her appetite. Some of you can probably relate with Hannah here, that maybe the desperation that you're facing in your life comes in the form of a difficult person, that maybe you have a Peninnah in your life who just makes life hard on you. And notice in the passage it says that this went on year after year. So every year, Peninnah makes sure to remind Hannah of her barrenness and her inability to have a child. So where is Elkanah in the situation? How does he try to comfort his hurting wife? Let's read in verse 8. Her husband Elkanah would say to her, "Hannah, why are you weeping? Why don't you eat? Why are you downhearted? Don't I mean more to you than 10 sons? So husbands in the room, take note of Elkanah, of all the things you should not do when comforting your wife. He makes a lot of rookie mistakes here. One, if your wife comes to you upset, don't try to tell her that she should not be upset. That is not very effective husbanding. I will admit, I probably made that mistake a time or two with Rachel, and it's never been very effective. She may come and share with me how she's had a bad day and how she's upset, and I may rationally explain to her why she doesn't need to be upset, but that's obviously not very helpful. So sorry, honey, if I've been an Elkanah to you. But rather, one should comfort his wife and listen to her feelings rather than tell her that her feelings are wrong. And the next mistake, maybe the worst mistake for Elkanah, is he tries to comfort her by saying, "But at least you got me as a husband. I mean, you won the husband lottery. Why are you upset? Isn't having me enough?" I don't think that one would go over very well with Rachel. I think she would laugh in my face. So Hannah is going through this difficulty of wanting children but not being able to have them. She has a rival wife that continues to provoke her, and she has a husband that doesn't understand and is a terrible comforter. So at this point, Hannah feels broken and desperate. So what does Hannah do? Let's look in verse 9. "Once when they had finished eating and drinking in Shiloh, Hannah stood up." And that line, that Hannah stood up, is a significant one. It doesn't just indicate a change of posture from going from sitting to standing, but it really means that she's had enough of living this way, and she wants something different. So she's going to try something different. That she's had enough of the pain and anguish year after year, so she's going to try a new path or a new direction. So Hannah stood up, a significant line. Continuing on, "Now Eli the priest was sitting on his chair by the doorpost of the Lord's house. In her deep anguish, Hannah prayed to the Lord, weeping bitterly, as she made a vow, saying, 'Lord Almighty, If you will only look on your servant's misery and remember me, and not forget your servant, but give her a son, then I will give him to the Lord for all the days of his life, and no razor will ever be used on his head." So Hannah prays this desperate prayer to God as she weeps bitterly. Maybe you've prayed this kind of desperate prayer before. Maybe it's been a time when you felt like you were just at the end of your rope in life, and you felt like you had nowhere else to turn, so you cried out to God for help. I think that's where Hannah is at that moment. And Hannah asks that God would see her pain and remember her. You know, Hannah, this probably was not the first time that she had prayed for a child. She may have very well felt like God had forgotten her. That after years and years of praying and no response, that maybe God doesn't hear her prayers, or even worse, maybe God doesn't care about her. But she makes a promise to God. She says, "If you will give me a son, I will give him back to you to serve you all the days of your life." In some ways, it seems like Hannah is trying to negotiate with God. And really, you cannot negotiate with God, because in order to negotiate, the other party, you have to have something that the other party would need in order to negotiate. And God doesn't need anything from Hannah. God doesn't need anything from us. We have nothing that God could need. So I think Hannah's prayer is different than negotiation with God. I think this is a prayer of surrender. She had prayed over and over again, "God, give me a son for me. Give me a son for me." But now her prayer has changed. It's now, "God, give me a son for you." You see, I think she is surrendering over to God. She promised that if God would give her a son, she would surrender him over to God to serve him all the days of his life. And she says that a razor will never touch his head. And this indicates what was called a Nazirite vow, which was a special vow that an Israelite could take that was dedicating themselves to God for special service to him. So she says, if God will give me a son, she would surrender him over to God. As one studies prayer, you will see that prayer is ultimately about surrendering your life to God and his plans. That we can come to God with our wants and our desires and ask him to fulfill our plans, but ultimately through prayer we learn to surrender to God's will for our life and what he wants for our life. That prayer is about learning to say honestly, as Jesus taught, "Your kingdom come and your will be done." I think we see that here in Hannah's promise to God. So let's continue in verse 12. As she kept on praying to the Lord, Eli observed her mouth. Hannah was praying in her heart, and her lips were moving, but her voice was not heard. Eli thought she was drunk and said to her, how long are you going to stay drunk? Put away your wine." "Not so, my Lord," Hannah replied. "I am a woman who is deeply troubled. I have not been drinking wine or beer. I was pouring out my soul to the Lord. Do not take your servant for a wicked woman. I have been praying here out of my great anguish and grief." Eli answered, "Go in peace, and may the God of Israel grant you what you have asked of him." She said, "May your servant find favor in your eyes." Then she went her way and ate something, and her face was no longer downcast. So one more person in the story who doesn't quite understand Hannah's pain. And this here is the priest of the Lord. But yet, rather than realizing what's going on, he thinks that she's drunk, that she's had too much wine. But once Hannah explains that she's not drunk, but that she's pouring out her soul to God in anguish, Eli then comforts her. And he says, "Go in peace, and may God grant you what you asked of him." And in verse 18, it says that Hannah left and she had something to eat. And it says that her face was no longer downcast. And I think that's interesting, because at this point, God has not answered her prayer yet, but yet we see a change in Hannah, that she's no longer filled with the same level of grief and pain. So what changed? Perhaps she has experienced the comfort of handing it over to God and choosing to trust his plan for her. So let's see God's response to Hannah in verse 19. Early the next morning, they arose and worshiped before the Lord, and then went back to their home at Ramah. Elkanah made love to his wife Hannah, and the Lord remembered her. So in the course of time, Hannah became pregnant and gave birth to a son. She named him Samuel, saying, "Because I asked the Lord for him." So God answers Hannah's prayer, and he gives her a son. She gives him the name Samuel, which sounds like the Hebrew word, which means heard by God. See, Hannah learned that God had not forgotten her. He had not abandoned her or turned away from her. He did see her pain and cared about her pain. She realized that God heard her prayers. I think one truth that we see in this story and throughout Scripture is that God is drawn to the desperate. He sees your hurt, he hears your cry, and he has not forgotten you. And though we may not always experience the answered prayer as Hannah did, we can take comfort in knowing that God is near us and he is working for our good. So as you continue to read the story, you see that Hannah keeps her promise to God, this amazingly difficult promise of giving up her son to be raised at the tabernacle for special service to God. So once the boy is old enough to be weaned, she brings him to Shiloh and she offers a sacrifice there, and then she gives him over to Eli. So skipping to verse 25. When the bull had been sacrificed, they brought the boy to Eli, and she said to him, "Pardon me, my lord. As surely as you live, I am the woman who stood here beside you praying to the Lord. I prayed for this child, and the Lord has granted me what I asked of him. So now I give him to the Lord. For his whole life he will be given over to the Lord," and he worshiped the Lord there. Can you imagine doing what Hannah did, to give your child over to be raised by someone else? I would think that would be incredibly difficult. But she keeps her promise to God, and she trusts in her plan, or in his plan for her life and for her son's life. She surrendered her son over to him. Later we see in chapter 2, starting in 18, how God continues to bless Hannah for her faithfulness. But Samuel was ministering before the Lord, a boy wearing a linen ephod. Each year his mother made him a little robe and took it to him when she went up with her husband to offer the annual sacrifice. Eli would bless Elkanah and his wife, saying, "May the Lord give you children by this woman to take the place of the one she prayed for and gave to the Lord." Then they would go home. And the Lord was gracious to Hannah. She gave birth to 3 sons and to 2 daughters. Meanwhile, the boy Samuel grew up in the presence of the Lord. So God does not stop with blessing her with one son, but he continues to bless her with 5 more children. And we have a different kind of prayer from Hannah at the beginning of chapter 2. Her prayer of desperation that we saw in chapter 1 is replaced with a prayer of praise to God. Here's a couple lines that we see in verse 1 and 2 of chapter 2. "My heart rejoices in the Lord. In the Lord my horn is lifted high. My mouth boasts over my enemies, for I delight in your deliverance. There is no one holy like the Lord. There is no one besides you. There is no rock like our God." Notice the change in Hannah's words from her first prayer to this prayer. That she goes from pleading with God to, "God, please see my pain and remember me. Do not forget me," to now saying, "I rejoice in the Lord. I have experienced his deliverance, that he is my rock, and there is no one like him." You see, our God is one who can move us from suffering to rejoicing. That he wants to take away our tears and replace it with joy. So may we lean on God as our rock and our deliverer. I can't help but wonder, how would this story have been different if God had answered Hannah's prayer the first time she prayed for a child? If the first time Hannah asked for a child, God said, "Okay, here," and gave her one, she would have avoided a lot of suffering. But she never would have made the promise to God to surrender over to him her son. Samuel would not have grown up the way that he did in the tabernacle, raised in God's service, but rather he would have grown up differently. But because of God's perfect timing and plan, Hannah learned to place her hope in God, and God was able to use Samuel as he was raised in service to him to become this great leader and priest for Israel. And Samuel even becomes the one to later anoint King David. See, God had a big plan for this son. And in Hannah's moment of desperation, she couldn't have seen or understood God's plan. But yet God was working things together for good. So may we learn to trust God in prayer, to trust that His plan is better than our plan. As a church family, may we pursue God in prayer and surrender to what it is that He wants to do with our lives. So one way that we're going to try to purposely pray this month is I want to invite you to pray at a specific time each day. So, and this isn't anywhere in your notes and it's not on the screen, so you may have to write it down, or it's okay if you want to get your phone out and set an alarm right now, you could do that. But I invite you to pray each day at 3:56 p.m. 3:56 p.m. So whatever you're doing, to take a moment at that time to stop and pray. We chose 3:56 based on Proverbs 3, 5, and 6. It's a verse that probably many of you know. Some of you, it may be your favorite verse. It's, "Trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge Him, and He will make your path straight." So I ask that you specifically pray for our church family every day at 3:56. That you pray that God help us to trust in Him, and that He may direct our paths for the future as we try to be a light for Him in this community. So let's pray together right now. God, I thank You for this amazing gift of prayer. God, I pray that we don't take for granted that we can come and speak to You, the Creator of the universe, and that You hear what we have to say and You care about what we have to say. God, I thank You for being a loving Father that welcomes us whenever we are desperate and broken. And God, I pray that we may learn to place our trust in You and to trust Your plan for our lives. Maybe be ones who surrender our lives over to You. And God, we just pray all of this in Your Son's name. Amen.